We will talk with the co-authors of Don't Stop Thinking About the Music this hour about the politics of songs and musicians in presidential campaigns. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Thursday, February the 2nd. If you have a question about why campaigns have selected various songs or views on whether a campaign song was effective or not, or a thought on whether campaign music influences our voting in any way, we invite you to join in at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us on Twitter at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guests. Very happy to have with us Benjamin Shaining, who is an assistant professor of music at the University of Wisconsin-Barron County and music director of the Red Cedar Choir in Rice Lake, and Eric Casper, an assistant professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Barron County and a municipal judge in Rice Lake. They are the co-authors of Don't Stop Thinking About the Music, the politics of songs and musicians in presidential campaigns. They both join us from our studios in Eau Claire. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Joy. Thanks for having us.
Thanks a lot for being here. This is going to be a lot of fun. I'm going to look forward to playing some of these selections and talking about why these songs were used or misused in campaigns. But first off, why did you collaborate on a book on campaign music and politics? And maybe I'll start with Professor Casper first on that.
Well, Joy, the two of us have, for the last few years, we've taught an interdisciplinary studies course at UW-Barron County, where we take what is my American politics and government course, and Benjamin comes in and discusses a musical aspect of American politics. And so it was from that course where we talk about all sorts of uses of music in politics, from national anthems to civil rights music to pro-war and anti-war music and so on. It was from that we started collaborating on the intersection of music and politics, and we ended up writing a paper on that we presented at a conference, and the paper was noticed by a publisher, and here we are.
Yeah, here you are indeed. And Professor Shaining, there's quite a bit of music in politics?
There's quite a bit. If you look at the history, music is one of the most prominent forces in swaying people's emotional decisions. And so the fact that music would be in politics is quite natural, as a lot of voting can come down sometimes to, you know, the way someone feels about a particular candidate.
And I guess that leads me to my next question, Professor Casper. I was going to say, does it really matter? Does it really matter what campaign song a campaign selects? And you're saying it does.
Well, I'd say that at least from the campaign's perspective, everyone who runs one of these presidential campaigns, they think that the music matters. They make use of it. Whether or not the music actually sways voters, that's another matter, and perhaps a more difficult one to answer. But there's no question the campaigns think that it matters. And, of course, there is a potential if you use the music in the wrong way or you choose a wrong song, that may deter people from following your campaign or from voting for you. But certainly they all think that it's important, that it needs to be done. They all do it. And so if a candidate didn't use music, that would also raise some eyebrows.
Oh, all right. Well, I assume since it's such an emotional trigger for us that it might indeed make us, I don't know, feel good or not so good about a particular candidate.
Oh, I'd have to say that I'd agree. I mean, it's part of the pageantry that politics can be. It's the same thing or something similar to all of the visual images that candidates will try to use, whether it's staging in the background with campaign signs or the use of the American flag or the much larger staging that would go on visually at national conventions. The music, the audio portion of that is important as well, and it can have an effect. That to what extent that might be, I think that's arguable, but certainly throughout human history, governments have seen the importance of music. That's why, you know, every government, every country has a national anthem. That's why candidates will make use of music, because they do see that emotional appeal that's there, and they try to take advantage of it.
I assume you picked the title Don't Stop Thinking About the Music because of President Clinton's campaign song?
Yes, indeed, we did. It's over the last 20 years, probably the most notable song that's come out of a campaign, and one that is still associated with President Clinton till this day, when he comes and makes political speeches, or when he's introduced at the Democratic National Conventions. It's always used as a way to introduce him, and many people really associate the song directly with him still to this day.
Yeah, and I guess as somebody who I'm a baby boomer, I listened to Fleetwood Mac in my teen years. In fact, that was the first live concert I went to was Fleetwood Mac, and it was a song that that appealed to me as a baby boomer. And it was noted that he was the first baby boomer president, and it did have that message of, you know, tomorrow will be a better day kind of a thing, I guess, or, you know, let's not forget about the days ahead. And do you think, Professor Shaning, that was a wise use of a song?
I do. Coming out of the 12 years of Republican presidency that we had, he's trying to project as a Democratic candidate this better way forward if the Democratic Party is elected into power, and more specifically him. And so I think it's a wonderful use in that way. And also, as you mentioned, he's the first baby boomer to be elected president, and that song really targets the baby boomer demographic, and one that he would go after heavily to try to garner the vote from.
Yeah. So is that maybe that's a case that one helped him a little bit, Professor Casper?
I think the song itself was a good choice for the Clinton campaign. As Benjamin was saying, it kept him on message. It helped focus the message on that, hey, we've got this better future if you go in this different direction politically. And also because it's tapping into a song that was already popular, a song that was popular with a voting demographic that would probably show up in pretty good numbers in 1992. I think it's a good song for that reason. Now, of course, one of the things that we talk about in the book is a term that we call musical misrepresentation. Maybe I'll turn this over to Benjamin to go into a little more detail on it. But obviously, the original intent of the song, when written by Fleetwood Mac, was not about a presidential candidate. It wasn't about going in a new direction politically. It was about something quite different.
Yeah, I mean, if you really look at the song, it's really about the pending divorce between two members of the band. So in that way, if the public is listening to the entire song, it might not be a great choice. But what we found is that campaigns try to not only find a song that's popular but has a really great hook, and one that's easy to remember, and where the hook of the song exemplifies something within their campaign. And the voting public tends to remember that hook, especially since you think on TV and on radio, when we hear that song, the campaign's going to make sure that that hook is what's heard over the air associated with their candidate, not the remainder of the song. But, you know, that misrepresentation, if the voting public is really pulling back and listening to a lot of these songs in their entirety, especially over the last 20 or 30 years, I think they might have a very different impression of their candidate than that, you know, 3 or 4 second little spot that the candidates really want you to remember.
Yeah, that's hilarious. In fact, you start the book with an example of this, I guess, musical misrepresentation or a mistake in the selection of a piece of music. I don't have the actual selection, and I'm glad I don't. It was the AC/DC song Thunderstruck. And you say that this was used by John McCain's campaign when they introduced Sarah Palin. What was wrong with that?
Well, the song, they had used it. I'm not sure how many times they used it, but they used it at least once at a campaign rally, which we tap into at the beginning of the book as sort of our hook to get people interested. Initially, you might think the name of the song is Thunderstruck. It's a song which presumably the McCain campaign was using because they thought, well, this is going to demonstrate that John McCain, if he's elected, he could, you know, he could be the person who strikes thunder into reinvigorating the American economy, or that he might strike thunder into Congress and get them to act. But if you listen to the song in its entirety, there is quite a bit going on in terms of involving rather unseemly things, perhaps a criminal behavior, sexual promiscuity, that sort of thing, which is the sort of thing that band is rather famous for in its music. But again, the way that these songs tend to get played at these rallies is they'll have the introduction, they'll get it to that hook where there might be that short message in the course of a few seconds or a very short snippet. And that's what the campaign then uses as a way to kind of package its message. And oftentimes they don't play the whole song because if they did, there might be a very different message that gets across to the people listening.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the very beginning. Let's hear a bit of a song that was in support of George Washington.
With heart in hand and God, our trust we'll freely fight. Our cause is just, march on, my lads. Lads, march on and follow Washington.
Well, that's a catchy little ditty. So how did these songs spread or catch on in the days before radio and recordings?
Well, it's actually quite interesting. And something to note is that a lot of these early songs weren't actually written for the specific campaigns. The Follow Washington, for example, was actually written about, you know, a lot of his military conquests and the Revolutionary War, as a number of other songs as they were getting ready to elect the first president. And a number of these songs would actually be used in the re-election bid. For a candidate, since they had been established, during their inauguration or something of the like. But these early songs tended to be what I'll call parodied, not in the ha-ha weird Al Yankovic style of parody where we're trying to insert words that, you know, present a new comic message into a song, but in the traditional sense of parody, where we're simply taking an existing song with a tune everyone knows and putting in a new set of words. And since a lot of the early campaign songs would have been spread through word of mouth, that was actually the most effective way to do it. Everyone knows the tune already, so getting them to associate at a campaign stop with those new words and then go to their town and sing the song and people catch up on this new catchy tune with the new words, and then they spread it to another town. Since, you know, it wasn't practical. They didn't have TV, obviously, or radio to disseminate message, and you were really limited in the number of campaign stops you could actually make.
Mm-hmm. And did every president or presidential candidate use some music?
I don't know that everyone has from the very beginning, but definitely if a candidate, especially in those early elections with Washington, Adams, and Jefferson, once they had been elected, songs would be written for the inauguration that would be used in the re-election bid. I think once we get into, you know, the 1820s or so, we really start to see campaign songs coming out for both sides, and it really tips the scale in 1840 with Tippecanoe and Tyler too, which really launches us in to what we're going to call the singing campaigns, where song becomes a vital focus to really disseminating the message of the candidates.
Let's take a listen.
It is the ball a-rollin' on for Tippecanoe and Tyler too, for Tippecanoe and Tyler too, and with them will be little Van is a used-up man.
I didn't know until very recently that was the campaign song. Why?
Well, I think the song itself, which actually has about 10 verses, 10 or 12 verses, I believe, extols both the virtues of the candidates, William Harrison and his running mate, John Tyler, as well as you could hear in that piece you just played, where they're talking about Little Van, he's a used-up man. They're talking about the incumbent president there, Martin Van Buren, which right off the bat shows you that negative campaigning is nothing new. It's always been with us. But the song itself becomes important, and music really rises to a prominent place in campaigns during that era because of a couple of different factors. One is that the right to vote was being expanded as you're moving through the late 1820s into the 1830s. You have Jacksonian reforms taking place at the state level when it comes to voter qualifications. And so property qualifications on voting were largely ending during this period. So one didn't have to own a large tract of land to be able to vote. Obviously, there were still limitations on the right to vote with respect to race, with respect to sex. But these property qualifications were being eliminated at the time. And so music becomes an important way to spread the message to a changing voting public and to a voting public which now has a larger percentage of voters who may not be literate, a larger percentage of voters who may not have any strong formal education. And so music becomes one key way of trying to reach out to them, getting them to remember through a jingle what the virtues of a particular candidate are or what the downside of their opponent might be.
And even further than that, sometimes it's not even about extolling the virtues of a candidate or the downside of your opponent. It's just about creating buzz about your candidate in general, which actually is what that song tends to do. And even Martin Van Buren had on the campaign trail been talking about, you know, potential problems with alcoholism. And if you listen to parts of that song, they're saying, you know, let them talk about hard cider. We're going to keep the ball rolling. You know, those things don't matter. And perhaps he was actually the first president we would talk about as, you know, the one you'd want to sit down and have a beer with, right. You know, along those lines. But, you know, sometimes just generating buzz is the best way to, you know, create that hype about your candidate. And the song did that very well.
We are talking about campaign songs and music and politics. We'll hear some more campaign songs from the past and the present, and we hope you'll call in with your thoughts or questions about the use of campaign songs in politics or maybe the misuse of them. There have been some recent controversies where a campaign might have picked a song that they thought was a catchy one to illustrate their campaign, and then the artist was upset and wanted it to stop. So we'll talk about some of those examples as well. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Is there a presidential campaign song that sticks in your mind? Do you think that that this is important in terms of our voting decisions? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our guests are the co-authors of Don't Stop Thinking About the Music, The Politics and of Songs and Musicians in Presidential Campaigns. That's Kid Rock, Born Free. And the reason I'm playing it is that it's a song that Mitt Romney is using on the campaign trail. I don't know if that shows that Mitt is hip or no, it shows that he thinks that it's important to be born free, I guess. We are talking about campaign songs and music and politics. Our guests are the authors of Don't Stop Thinking About the Music, The Politics of Songs and Musicians in Presidential Campaigns. They are Benjamin Shaning, an assistant professor of music at the University of Wisconsin-Barron County, music director of the Red Cedar Choir in Rice Lake, and Eric Casper, an assistant professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Barron County, and the municipal judge in Rice Lake. Again, both of the co-authors of this book, Don't Stop Thinking About the Music. And I know that you didn't write about Mitt Romney's use of Born Free, But Mitt Romney is also in a little bit of hot water. I guess a rapper is upset that Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney used his song Wavin' Flag during his Florida primary victory speech and is even seeking legal action as a result of that. How common is this, the controversies over the use of music by campaigns and from the musician?
Well, I think since we got to this time period where popular music is tending to be the trend for presidential candidates, it's actually becoming more of a common occurrence. And this is actually a unique case from what I've read about it, in that the Romney campaign actually had a license to use the song, but the rapper is still upset. And that's not actually all that uncommon. Because of what we'll call implied endorsement, in that candidates will sometimes select a song, whether it's their official song or just a song they're going to play on the campaign trail, because they think it will not only project a good campaign message, but they feel it will appeal to a certain demographic of a voter that maybe their candidate doesn't necessarily appeal to normally. And also, you know, as the media and popular artists have become more entwined in politics, it's not uncommon for a candidate to want to try to associate themselves with a particular artist as another way to try to show that, you know, they're more in tune with, you know, in Romney's case, maybe this artist tends to be more left-leaning, and so he's trying to show that side of the aisle that, you know, he can be a little bit more hip to their concerns.
Very good. Did you have something to add, Professor Shaney?
That was Benjamin who was
talking.
About. I would wholeheartedly agree with this notion that now that the use of popular songs has exploded in these campaigns within the last few decades, that this type of thing does occur more often. And sometimes it becomes a problem because the campaigns, although they've secured the copyright permissions, the actual ownership of that song is not in the hands of the artist anymore. And so the artist doesn't like what's happened, but they don't have any legal recourse. Of course, the other problem is if a campaign uses a song and they haven't sought to secure the copyright permissions. And one of the ones where this has happened multiple times was a song by Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, I Won't Back Down, which is a song which, as a candidate, I mean, it's got a great message. I mean, look, I'm not going to back down. If there's trouble, I'll stand up, and presumably I'll stand up on behalf of the country if I'm elected. But it's been used in recent years both by the George W. Bush campaign in 2000, and then it was used by Michelle Bachmann last year. And neither one of them had secured the copyright permissions, and they got, in each case, an unwelcomed cease and desist letter from Tom Petty's attorneys, which doesn't make for good headlines either. So usually when that sort of thing does happen, the campaigns, even in this instance where they choose the song I Won't Back Down, if they get letters from lawyers, they tend to back down when they don't have a legal leg to stand on. And that sort of thing is becoming more common because popular music is being used more and more in these campaigns.
Well, we have callers waiting, so let me go to the phones. Chris in Oshkosh is with us. Hello, Chris.
Hi. I was just wondering if they had any thoughts on back in 1984 when Walter Mondale used, I think it was a Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young song with lines in it about teach your children well. But what he was kind of saying in the overplay of the commercial where he was talking was that President Reagan was not going to tell you that he's going to have to raise your taxes, and that he did just tell you. So it was just kind of flat and off theme and just didn't really seem to fit.
Now let's take a listen. We actually have that one.
Hoover on the road must have a code that you can live by.
Yeah, that was my mom's favorite song, but it doesn't have a whole lot to do with not raising your taxes, does it?
Well, that can be part of the problem, especially once you enter the TV age, where campaigns will try to have a marriage of a song with whatever visual images or whatever voiceover there might be in a campaign ad, for instance. And that's actually one of the areas where you see campaign songs sort of not being used as much anymore. I mean, if you look at the typical TV advertisements that campaigns use today, they don't tend to use music with words. It tends to be something that's receded into the background musically. And so it becomes either in a negative ad, something that's, you know, a dark and foreboding type of music, or in a positive advertisement, something that's maybe a little happier and sunnier in terms of background music. But this attempt to have this marriage between the music and the visual, or between the music and a voiceover, has not worked particularly well, at least for the thriving of the music. And so we tend to see the music that's more effective, sort of more upbeat or more on message, being used on the campaign trail, being used either as warm-up music before a speech, or the music that's used when a speech is closed by a candidate.
I'd like to talk about this one next.
Ooh, baby, yeah, I'm still delivered, I'm yours. Hey, here I am, baby. Oh, you got the feeling in my head.
So that was President Obama used that song quite a bit of. But I guess we didn't hear the lyrics all that much, but we heard a little bit of it. Why was that? Why did the Obama campaign pick that, Professor Kasman?
It's got that great hook, that great line, signed, sealed, delivered, I'm yours. That it's basically I think fits in with this message that any candidate would probably like to associate themselves with. That, you know, look, if you vote for me, you elect me as your president. I'm your person. I will do the work for you. I will make this country a better place. I'll work on your behalf. Again, though, and I'll turn this over to Benjamin, the song itself, not written with that intent when it was originally produced.
No, the song was about a lover, and I almost want to say it was about an unfaithful lover. Coming back and, you know, pleading, saying, you know, I know I've done some horrible things in my life, but, you know, I have, you know, fixed them, and now I'm ready to be yours. So in that way, it's a little bit off message. But at the same time, in a way, it actually almost works for the Obama campaign. As you remember, we were talking about things like the cocaine use earlier in his life. And so that maybe actually was a good message for the campaign to say, you know, I was young once too, like everyone else. I've done some foolish things, but I've learned to grow up. And now I'm ready to be your leader because I've had the value of having those experiences from which to lead from.
Another call from Daniel in Rice Lake. Hello, Daniel.
Hello. Bush's W's election campaign used the Who's Won't Get Fooled Again. They carefully edited out the crucial and very radical Townsend line, meet the new boss, same as the old boss.
Pretty good. You noticed that, huh, Daniel?
Yeah, I certainly did.
Any comment on that, Professor Shaney?
You know, it's wonderful when you can magically manipulate the song so it works very well for you, and you can hide kind of that message of, you know, welcome to more of the same, you know.
Yeah, and I think you find that virtually every campaign does that to a certain extent, maybe not through editing out particular parts of a song, but certainly through choosing which parts of the song they're going to play and having control over that to make sure that if there is another part of the song that would take them off message or maybe give voters some other idea about what the message is, they don't play that part of the song. And we see that happen quite frequently during this more popular music-focused era that we're in now.
Well, let's take a listen to one of the more famous campaign songs in presidential campaign history.
Happy days are here again, the skies above are clear again. Let us sing a song of cheer again. Happy days are here again.
Of course, I said that it was one of the more popular ones, but it's certainly one of the better known ones. This is Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Happy Days Because We're Coming Out of the Depression, Professor Kasper.
Yeah, that was the vision that he was trying to portray, that even though they were in the grips of the Great Depression at the time when he first used the song in 1932. The point of the song is that, well, if you elect Roosevelt, yes, happy days will be here again. And that was actually a very early use of an existing popular song or an existing song that wasn't changed by the campaign. There's a lot of the early use of campaign music throughout American history, as Benjamin had noted earlier. They were taking maybe an existing tune and adding new lyrics to it about the candidate. With Happy Days Are Here Again, the Roosevelt campaign used the entirety of the song. And that was sort of one of the very early usages of that, you know, trying to appeal to the popular music all together, not just the tune, but the lyrics as well.
Mm-hmm. Professor Shaney, anything to add?
You know, it's interesting to watch the progression. If you know, looking at the 19th century, as Dr. Casper was saying, we're taking the entire existing song and really rewriting all the lyrics, and moving into the turn of the 20th century with, you know, some of the popular songs that were coming out of Tin Pan Alley, and now we're actually writing completely new campaign songs. And as you move forward into the mid 20th century, they kind of try to split the difference a little bit. They'll look for a song that talks about their candidate, but that they can manipulate a little bit within the body of the song, so you have a lot of the catch that people understand in the song with the subtle manipulations about the candidate, and then fully moving into this use of popular music. So in a way, Roosevelt was far ahead of his time, forward thinking, almost, 70 years.
I think I have an example here where we have a famous celebrity who records a famous song with the lyrics changed.
'Cause he's got high hopes. He's got high hopes. 1960's the year for his high hopes. Come on and vote for Kennedy. Vote for Kennedy and we'll come out on.
There we go. Vote for Kennedy. That's catchy.
Not only is it catchy, but you have Sinatra singing it, which is, one of the best endorsements that you can have. And it's something that, ironically, we didn't see a lot of in the 19th century. It's not until the advent of radio that candidates found it, important in some way to actually try to hook on to some popular radio voice of the day, or actually, I think the early one was Al Jolson, who was not only a great radio personality, but was big into the minstrel shows and the vaudeville, and so had this hype around him in that way. And candidates early on, once the radio became a prominent staple, learned that latching on to a prominent figure could really boost their notoriety.
Maybe that's one case where that music and the endorsement of Sinatra might have made a difference in that campaign, Professor Casper?
It's quite possible, and given Sinatra's popularity at the time, and of course using this, what wasn't an already existing popular song, and just tweaking it a bit to make it focus on Kennedy and why it would be a good idea to elect him. And it goes to this idea of that the technology kind of drives how the songs get used, as Dr. Shaney was saying, once you get the radio, you get more of this focus on celebrity, and politicians, they're not idiots. They're going to see, okay, if there's something to be gained in the marketplace by trying to attach yourself to celebrities and celebrity endorsements, there might be something to be gained in the political world as well when you're running for office. So I think High Hopes is a very good example of melding those two together, of using both a popular song and a popular celebrity to try and help you win at the ballot box.
We are talking with the co-authors of Don't Stop Thinking About the Music, The Politics of Songs and Musicians in Presidential Campaigns. Eric Casper is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Barron County, and Benjamin Shaney is an assistant professor of music at the University of Wisconsin-Barron County. And They collaborated on this book to talk about how presidential candidates choose their election songs, the relationship between election politics and campaign songs. And we're welcoming your questions, your examples. Maybe there's a campaign song that stands out to you. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So, name that song and which candidate currently running for president it is linked to. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That is Imperial March. And we'll find out the significance of that as we continue talking with our guests, the co-authors of Don't Stop Thinking About the Music, The Politics of Songs and Musicians in Presidential Campaigns. I have to admit, I didn't realize that I guess I consider that Darth Vader's theme song is being used for Ron Paul, Republican presidential candidate Ron Paul, Professor Casper?
Well, it was used by his campaign one time, to my knowledge. It was after the night of the New Hampshire primary. That was the music that was played by the campaign when he went on stage to speak. You know, every once in a while you get one of these songs and the way they're used, and you just scratch your head and ask yourself, what were they thinking? Darth Vader isn't the one I'd want to associate myself with in terms of fictional characters, and it doesn't seem to fit what his general message is, but sometimes it does happen where that gets used, and it's probably... was used by the campaign with the thinking of this is an attention-getting song. This is to state the boldness of the campaign that it'll continue moving forward, even though they didn't win that primary that night. But the other themes that are potentially associated with it, they do make you scratch your head. And we've seen this in other contexts before. At least for me personally, I think the other one that's notable in this respect was in 1992 when Ross Perot made use of Crazy by Patsy Cline.
Let's take a listen to that.
Crazy, I'm crazy for feeling so lonely.
Why in the world he actually picked that himself?
He did. You know, most campaigns are trying to control their message, and they pick songs that they feel project a very positive image of their candidate. However, Ross Perot, with the number of times he had gotten in the campaign and out of the campaign and some of the things he had said on the trail, and the media had gotten this image that he was crazy, and he kind of tried to spin it and say that, yes, he was crazy like a fox, and they were going to win the election. And so he actually allowed the media in a way to pick his song, which, as Dr. Casper said, this is one of the most baffling things that you see. You scratch your head when you think about the fact that your candidate is picking a song that, you know, exemplifies exactly what the media is trying to say about him instead of trying to spin it around and pick a song that would, you know, contradict the images that are there. But in a way, it's maybe a bold and errant strategic move on his part to try to poke fun at the media for what they're saying about him.
I want to talk to you both about the Hillary Clinton's campaign, because I remember back then she was getting a public input too into what should be my campaign song, and this is what she ended up with. Now, you notice that Rob Ferret, my director, played very little of that music and lots of the Darth Vader song. No, I'm just kidding. but the I remember there was some kind of, you know, should it be
When I saw her face by the what is it, Smashing Pumpkins or I'm a Believer by the Monkees, or I can't remember. She had all sorts of different selections, and that's what apparently the public voted, that they liked that one the best. Is that how that worked, Professor Casper?
Well, that's one of the ways in which technology has changed the ways that songs are used by these campaigns, in that the Clinton campaign in 2008 put a list of about 10 songs online and allowed supporters to go on there. And, of course, I mean, effectively anyone could go on there, but she was encouraging supporters to go online and then vote for the song they liked the best, and then that would be the one that they would go with for the campaign. And so one of these things about the internet era that allows a little more involvement between the candidates and the voting public. Of course, one of the issues that is raised with that is if the list is too long, you risk a song being chosen by your followers that maybe you don't really like, or you risk your followers being divided about what songs should be chosen, and that might take you off message as far as media coverage. Of course, one of the other things about that song and why the Clinton campaign got criticized a bit is that it's by Celine Dion, a Canadian artist, which was originally written as a campaign jingle, or as an ad jingle for a Canadian air company.
Okay.
And so to use that when you're running for the presidency of the United States, she was criticized a bit for that. But otherwise, it is another one of these ways that exemplifies the changing nature of what music gets chosen and how it's used based on technological changes that are occurring.
So, Professor Shaning, which of the Clinton selections would you have voted for?
You know, listening to all of them, I think that was as good as any, to be honest. And because, you know, even though we have this Canadian theme with the airline and Celine Dion, the message of the song overarchingly is exactly what she wanted to project, especially coming out of the Bush era with the economic declines that were going on, et cetera, et cetera. So this idea of projecting that we want to take the country under our wings and lift them up is actually a great message. It just happens to be it's from a Canadian artist, which kind of puts you at odds with yourself as an American nominee.
Well, let's go back to a well-known song that was used by Ronald Reagan in his 1984 campaign.
And I'm proud to be.
Boy, I didn't even realize that was from 1984, because it was used so much in the 2000s following 9/11. But that seems like that was a good fit for the Reagan campaign, Professor Casper.
Yeah, it was a song that was already popular. It was already in existence before the campaign. It is doing very well on the country charts. It was used as sign-off music when TV stations went off the air. And so it was, in that sense, a song that was already popular. And even though it was the song taken in its entirety and the lyrics weren't changed, the lyrics themselves already presented a message to the voting public that the Reagan campaign liked, and that it wasn't just the hook. If you listen to the entire song, it's focusing on the virtues of America, support of freedom, and support of military heroes. And so the song as a whole actually has a great message that the Reagan campaign certainly made use of, and that's why they chose the song, because of the great message behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And this was actually the groundbreaking song, too, when you think about it. Popular songs had been used off and on. We've talked about FDR and Happy Days Are Here Again. In 1972, Bridge Over Troubled Waters was used. And these songs could be used in their entirety, but they weren't used very often. However, once Reagan really breaks ground with God Bless the USA in 1984, that's when the use of popular music is set firmly in stone, and we don't see a lot of going back to taking popular songs and changing lyrics as the main staple of a campaign any longer.
And the other thing I would add is that I don't think it's any surprise that the presidents who are otherwise typically known as great communicators, whether it's Franklin Roosevelt or Ronald Reagan or Bill Clinton, also are very good at choosing effective music and choosing music that will communicate their message. I think that the two tend to go hand in hand, and you see that with all three of them. The other thing besides that with Clinton, besides Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow, was, of course, his attempted use at himself being a musician, playing the saxophone, and trying to appeal to voters in that aspect. And so you see with a lot of these presidents who are, or a lot of these candidates initially who are great communicators, they're also effectively using music as a means of communication.
Very funny. We just heard President Obama singing a little bit of Al Green a couple of weeks ago. Did you catch that, Professor Shading?
I did indeed. And if you also recall, Mitt Romney on the campaign trail, I believe, has been singing America the Beautiful.
Yeah, if you call
so,
it that.
You know, at least he's been reciting the lyrics. So I think candidates are seeing the value of not only using popular musicians in their songs, but also being musicians themselves and trying to portray themselves as very populist in that way.
That's a dangerous thing to do if you don't have musical ability, though. So it is fraught with danger.
You won't catch me doing that, that's for sure. But you know, I wanted to talk a little bit about "Born in the USA" by Bruce Springsteen was also a song that I thought Ronald Reagan used a little bit before Bruce Springsteen said "Stop it." Is that right?
Well, he tried to associate himself with Bruce Springsteen. And, I mean, where this originated from was a speech that he gave, I believe, in New Jersey, where he was talking about Born in the USA and trying to associate himself with the song, which was very popular at the time, and with Springsteen. Springsteen, who is politically a liberal, didn't want Reagan making use of his song or even making reference to it, and so he came out publicly against it. Of course, later on, I mean, there have been endorsements that Springsteen has made. I think most notably, he was very much in support of John Kerry in 2004. There was even, as I recall, a large rally in Madison.
That's why I wanted to bring that up. He drew a huge crowd, and I don't know if it was Springsteen or Kerry that, you know, or both that drew that crowd.
Well, it certainly helped. I mean, obviously, presidential candidates, when they're their party's nominee, they're going to draw a big crowd wherever they go. But it helps when you have a big musical celebrity as your opening act as well. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, what is the cutting edge of music and politics today? What kinds of things are you looking for in our last? We only have a couple of minutes to go, Professor Shaning.
Well, I guess I'm looking at how they're going to incorporate technology. And we saw that already in 2008 with Hillary Clinton and using the internet as a means for her constituents to become a more active participant, not just in the day-to-day operations of the campaign, but actually in the campaign message itself. Something we've also seen, and I think we're going to see a lot more, is that it's not just warm-up music that candidates are going to change as they go around the country, but we're going to see candidates using multiple songs as their theme songs based on where they are in the country and what is going on in the campaign at a particular moment. I think what campaigns are realizing is that while having one unified message is great, and if you're having a wonderful campaign like Bill Clinton was, it's very effective. You know, campaigns ebb and flow. You're up in the polls, you're down in the polls, and having multiple songs to keep your constituents with you and pushing forward is a very valuable tool to have in your arsenal.
Yeah, and we have less than a minute. 30 seconds, Professor Casper, for your last thoughts.
Yeah, I would say that the other big thing that's happening right now with the internet is campaigns don't have quite as much control as they used to. And with websites like YouTube, for instance, it's very easy for anyone to upload a song which could then take off virally. And so there's a potential there for new songs that the campaigns don't have anything to do with initially that take off, and that becomes the next big thing that's newsworthy about the campaign.
Well, this has been a lot of fun. I want to thank you both very much for being with us. And we will let Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow take us out. I'm Joy Cardine. We're talking with the co-authors of Don't Stop Thinking About the Music. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.